Well, as I've been working my way through 1 Samuel on Wednesday nights primarily, I guess I did bring one message on Sunday evening out of 1 Samuel, but as I've been working through this, it's been quite interesting. It's good to remember that this is the close of an era, and never is that more apparent than in this chapter. What is happening in these opening chapters of 1 Samuel is the closing out of the time of the judges. And really we have a pronouncement on that time through the mouth of Phinehas' wife as she names her child Ichabod. The glory has departed. And the actions that we see the Israelites engage in tonight, their actions towards the ark, really testify, you know, just how low they've come, just how pagan they've become in their thinking. And the unifying theme, when we look at chapters 4, 5, and 6, the unifying theme is the ark of God. Just to give you a feel for this, in these three chapters, there is a reference to the ark of God 34 times, okay? That's in three chapters. In the 52 remaining chapters of 1 and 2 Samuel, it's only mentioned 27 times. Just to let you know, what are these chapters? What is the central theme? It's the Ark of the Lord and the covenant that it represented. And so their treatment of the Ark is representative of the God that they, you know, how they're treating God in that relationship that covenant represents there. Again, the purpose of these chapters is to demonstrate just how corrupt the nation had become. We've already studied at length how corrupt the priesthood had become, and the priesthood had been rebuked. Eli has been rebuked. A prophecy has come twice concerning the judgment upon his house. And now what is apparent in chapter 4 is that the nation, that the people, are just as bad as the priests are. Okay, they have gone as far from the Lord as Hophni and Phinehas have, and demonstrating that they are in fact worthy of judgment. God will answer this by sending them the king they deserve, okay, in the person of Saul, and then giving them the king that they need in the person of David. But the reason they receive Saul is what we're looking at here tonight, as we see how far they've gone from the Lord and, you know, God giving them what they deserve in the person of Saul. Well, let's go ahead and begin here, beginning in verse 1. Let me read it for us. Thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer, while the Philistines camped in Aphek. The Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. This is the first mention of the Philistines in the book of Samuel. Not the first mention in Scripture. We have several references to them previously, and so I just wanted to maybe introduce you to them as we begin to see them for the next several chapters, 4, 5, and 6. We will see a lot of the Philistines. In fact, throughout the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, we'll hear a lot about the Philistines. We are told in Scripture that they came from the place of Kaphtor. That's the name of their origin. This is possibly a reference to Crete. The island of Crete. And we know about the Cretans, right? We studied them this morning. Always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This must go back generations. The Philistines were Cretans. And so they're from Kaphtor. Again, we don't know that for certain, but it's been suggested that they came from Crete. They were a ocean-going people, and they came from the ocean. They were not descendants of Canaan. They were descendants of Mizraim, which was, you have Ham, Mizraim and Canaan. Canaan and Mizraim were they weren't brothers. I think one was an uncle. But at any rate, they did come from Ham through Mizraim. And of course, Mizraim is also the father of the Egyptians. Okay, so there's a common root here. There's a common ancestry with the Egyptians, but not the Canaanites. They occupied the southwest coast of Israel, of Canaan, you might say at that time, before the arrival of Abraham. When Abraham shows up on the scene, the Philistines are already there and already established as a people. And they became an ever-increasing threat to Israel during the time of the judges. You might remember several of the judges. At least three were raised up to battle the Philistines. The most noteworthy was who? Samson. Yes, Samson was the most noteworthy. He battled the Philistines. And this threat would continue to grow throughout even the book of 1 and 2 Samuel. Saul battles the Philistines continually. David battles the Philistines continually. But interestingly enough, after David, they never pose a serious threat to Israel again. They seem to be sufficiently subdued to where they're, you know, the minor power as compared to Israel after this point. But he begins here. He concluded in chapter 3, speaking very clearly about how God had revealed himself to Samuel and that Samuel was confirmed to be a prophet. And we see in verse 1 here that he continues with that idea as he's changing into this new thought. He wants us to remember, thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Here's a confirmed prophet. They know he's a prophet, and he, you know, he's delivered messages to them. He has communicated to them. He has continually drawn our attention to this fact that he is confirmed to be a prophet, and this will become significant as we move along into the chapter. But Ebenezer, this is where their first battle takes place between Ebenezer and Aphek. I don't know how well you'll be able to see this. This is actually kind of a three-dimensional drawing of the land. This is south, north, west, and east. This is the land of the Philistines. They had the coastal plain down here in the south. Israel at this point, Judah, Ephraim, Benjamin, they're occupying the hills here. The Philistines occupy the coastland. And they're coming down to meet them for battle between Aphek and Ebenezer. It's about 20 miles distance to travel from Shiloh, right here, down to Aphek. That'll be significant later. Does that map work for you? Okay. I didn't know if it'd be easier to see or not, a three-dimensional map like that. Oh. Well. You'll handle that, right? That's what you told me? Okay. We had a conversation about this. He gave me a crash course. Okay, so here they are, Ebenezer and Aphek. 4,000 men on the side of Israel died. Not a resounding defeat, but a defeat nonetheless. And so they're rattled by this. They are trying to figure out why it is, and that's what we see in verse 3. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies." Now, as believers and students of the Bible, it almost seems ridiculous that these leaders are saying, "Why has the Lord defeated us?" As we read the Old Testament consistently, and this was the message of the law, that if they followed the Lord, then he would be with them. And when they were not following the Lord, then he would give them over to their enemies. Note here, there's the elders of Israel. So this is the leadership that is begging this question. Their question reveals that they have learned nothing during the time of the judges. Almost four centuries worth of history that has gone on, and they have learned nothing. What was the time of the judges characterized by? Turn back with me to the beginning of Judges. We're in Samuel, so you're not too far away. Judges chapter 2. We have a nice little introductory summary so that we know what the remainder of the book is going to unfold like, what we are going to see happen in Israel for centuries. We're not just talking decades here. We're talking centuries that this went on. Judges chapter 2, look at verse 11. "Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. So they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroth. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Whenever they went, wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them. As the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them, so they were severely distressed. Then the Lord raised up judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they played the harlot after other gods and bowed themselves down to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do as their fathers. This is the conclusion of that era. And very important statement there, verse 17, they did not listen to their judges. This is that God has finally come to the end of himself as far as dealing with these people. The judges would come and they would deliver them, but they were not listening to them. They were not learning anything by him handing them over to their enemies, as it was described there. Now we have kind of the ultimate here, a very ironic, symbolic, if you will, occurrence that demonstrates that God, in fact, they had violated and treated as common the covenant between them and their God. The author has gone to great lengths to inform us that Samuel had been confirmed as a prophet. Why does he do this? Why does he tell us that from Dan to Beersheba, from Dan in the north and Beersheba in the south, everyone knew that Samuel had been confirmed as a prophet? The reason is because when they have this dilemma, they don't go and consult him. They do not go and inquire of the one who has been established as a prophet. Instead, they hatch their own idea how to deal with the situation, revealing, again, their ignorance. Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the ark of the covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies. What is the key word in that statement? Can anybody see it? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the ark of the covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemy. It. That's the key word here, is it. Note they don't say that the Lord may come among us and deliver us. No, they say that it will do. The box, right? The box did so much for Joshua. They marched around Jericho 7 times and boom, it all came down. What is this revealing here? It shows that Israel was functioning on the same level as their pagan neighbors. They were viewing the ark quite the same that a pagan views his idol as bearing some sort of strength, some sort of power, some sort of magical power that would be a good luck charm to them. This chapter is filled with irony, and it begins here. Here they speak of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. The name of the Lord is on their lips. Yahweh is on their lips, that it may come among us and deliver us. This reveals their ignorance. This reveals that the name of the Lord can be on your mouth, and yet at the same time, you have no idea who he is. That is what this statement reveals. This is telling us what's wrong with the nation right here. They were just like Hophni and Phinehas. Chapter 2, verse 12, they did not know the Lord. That was the problem of the nation here. They did not know the Lord. They were not trying to force God's hand. I do not see this as an instance where they're trying to manipulate God and putting God to the test. I just think God's not even in the picture anymore. Their idea of God is the ark, having some sort of power that would be able to deliver them. This is viewing things, again, as their pagan neighbors did, as an ignorant pagan. would view them. Well, verse 4, it continues on. So the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who sits above the cherubim, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. As the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth resounded. The author offers another touch of irony here. The people, it says, the people sent to Shiloh, they took the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who sits above the cherubim. Now remember here, earlier we had the statement of the elders as they're hatching their plan, and the emphasis is laid upon the Ark delivering them. But now the author is speaking, and he said, they took the Ark. And what were they taking? They were taking the throne of God. They were taking away the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. And where was the Lord's presence? It sits. Who sits, it says, above the cherubim. This was God's throne. That's what David calls it. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 2, we'll look at that first. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 2. And David, this is again, 1 and 2 Samuel were one scroll originally. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 2. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him to Baal Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. See, they came, they think that they're just getting, you know, a magical fetish-like item that will bring them good luck. But in fact, we should not be surprised when we read just a few chapters from now in 1 Samuel 8, 7, the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you. They're asking for a king. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. You see the irony? Here they are. They had already rejected the Lord and just taking his throne here. There's some irony here. There's some symbolism going on here. They're doing so ignorantly, but the message is very clear. They don't know this God and they don't value this God. They certainly don't value the covenant that they have entered into with him. They don't know him. Well, it says the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. The fact that they were going with them demonstrates that here they are, their solidarity. Again, Hophni and Phinehas, they do not know the Lord. They're as blind as the people. They go right along with this. They think that they are pronouncing their blessing upon this idea, this plan. Makes one wonder if they were even aware. Had they heard the prophecies against Eli's house? Had they heard the sign? Perhaps Dad was wise enough not to say this to them. I don't know. That they would die in the same day. It is interesting to me when we look at Hosea 4, 9, centuries later, when Israel is going into the Assyrian captivity, Hosea writes, and it will be like people like priests, so I will punish them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. We're seeing a similar instance here. From the top to the bottom, both were going to be punished. Both were going to be carried away in destruction. Well, the Ark comes into the camp, and what does Israel do? Israel shouted with a great shout. What does this reveal? It reveals just how deluded they are. It reveals that their thinking is so far from God, they have no idea what they're doing right now. They think that they've gained their purpose, but in fact, they've just ensured their demise. Now the Lord, they've taken a very a high hand against the Lord, and he will punish them for this. Well, verse 6, he continues on. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. The Philistines were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. And they said, woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight. It is interesting to me, as I was reading this, to take a step back and say, why does the author enlighten us to what's going on into the Philistine camp? When we get this snapshot of the Philistine response to it, really what I think we are seeing is we're seeing what was happening in the hearts of Israel. We are seeing that they were functioning on the same level as their pagan neighbors. What is their response? What do the Philistines do? They were afraid. The Israelites were emboldened. The Philistines are afraid. Why? For they said, God has come into the camp. As if they had, again, that whole concept of an idol. You bring the physical object in, well, you've got God there. Israel was in fact treating the Ark of the Covenant as if it was God. And they were functioning on the same level as the Philistines. I find it interesting also that in over three centuries again, almost four centuries has elapsed since the time of the Exodus, and yet the Philistines are still talking about what God had done among the Egyptians. God had made himself a reputation among Israel's neighbors in that, and that now Israel has long since forgotten that God. Well, it says there how they strengthen themselves. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight. You stop and think about that. You think about men who are going into battle and don't know the Lord. What's the most they can say to each other? Well, strengthen yourselves. You don't want to be somebody's slave, do you? Here are some people, they really, that is the plight of the pagan. They do not have a God that can strengthen them. And so they strengthen themselves with really what are empty words. Empty words. Their sole motivation is to make sure that their lot in this world is not decreased in any way. That's the height of their encouragement to one another. Well, verses 10 and 11, it continues on. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. And the slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Verse 2, we read of 4,000 who died in the first battle. Now 30,000 fall of Israel. This is a resounding defeat compared to the earlier one. That is seven times the amount of casualties of those dead as a result of this battle. The sign promised to Eli is pronounced as coming to pass. Hophni and Phinehas died the same day. And most importantly, verse 11, the ark of God was taken. That is repeated again and again through the remainder of the chapter. Five times in verses 11 through 22, the phrase is repeated. The ark of God was taken. The ark of God was taken. Well, verse 12, he continues. Now a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn and dust on his head. When he came, behold, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road, eagerly watching, because his heart was trembling for the ark of God. So the man came to tell it in the city, and all the city cried out. The man ran 20 miles. He ran 20 miles to make his way to Shiloh from the battlefield. In that time, it says that he had torn his clothes and thrown dust on his head. Those were signs of mourning. It was almost as if it took for the ark to actually fall into the hands of their enemies before they actually realized what they had done. Eli does seem to have some sense here. I believe Eli was a believer. His heart is trembling here, it says. He's sitting watching anxiously. This was not something he obviously approved of. It wasn't something he stopped. In all fairness, he's 98 years old now. He's blind. He's very heavy. What is he going to do? In some ways, you see where if you don't do something early, at some point there's gonna come a time when you can't do anything. And that's where Eli is now. He can't do anything but sit there and tremble for what his sons foolishly are doing. He's sitting there eagerly, it says, watching because his heart was trembling for the ark of God. I think he did love the Lord, even though he faltered in so many ways and exalted his sons above the Lord. This instance here, in some ways, as we think about this, again, I see this as a positive thing. He's doing all that he can at this point. This is a fulfillment, by the way, of 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 32, where it says, "You will see the distress of my dwelling. You will see the distress of my dwelling in spite of all the good that I do for Israel." That's what he's doing right now. He's sitting here in kind of this panicked state, waiting to hear word what was going to happen. Certainly, the two times that he had received prophecies concerning the judgment of his two sons, the judgment of Israel, and so forth, had to be traveling through his mind. At this point, the man goes and reports to the city first. All the city cried out. One wonders, where was the outcry when they were taking the ark in the first place? But again, I think people were coming to their senses now in some ways. Verse 14 continues. "When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, 'What does the noise of this commotion mean?' Then the man came hurriedly and told Eli." Now, Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. The man said to Eli, "I am the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I escaped from the battle line today." And he said, "How did things go, my son?" Then the one who brought the news replied, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has also been a great slaughter among the people. And your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And the ark of God has been taken." When he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell off the seat backward beside the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for he was old and heavy. Thus he judged Israel 40 years. His eyes were dim, he was heavy, but he could still hear. The noise of the outcry in the city gets his attention. Eli could not see the dust on the man's head nor his clothes being torn, but there's definitely a hint that there was going to be a negative report in his initial words. "I escaped from the battle line today." That's never a good sign. That's ominous already. And so Eli, here he is in a state of trepidation. Now he's starting to get from the messenger that a negative outcome has happened, but still no word concerning the ark. He mentions the defeat. He mentions the death of his sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Eli's really not too stirred over the death of those two sons. When he mentioned the ark of God, he fell off the seat backward beside the gate. That was his greatest concern. To his credit, that was Eli's greatest concern here. The seat upon which he sat must have been perhaps his judgment seat, in which people would come to him and he would pass judgment on their cases. As judging Israel here, functioning, yes, as the key leader, but judge also functioned as, you know, settling disputes and so forth as well, which was a role for the high priest anyway in under the law as well. Priests would decide such things between, if there was a dispute between two people. This elevated seat, or I would say it seems to be elevated because of the way he dies, caused him to land on his head. I mean, if you're sitting on a low chair, you fall backwards, chances are you're not going to break your neck, but in this case, he did. In this, I do see, as we've watched, previously in the book, how many times has God spoken to Samuel? At least on two occasions, presumably, years elapsing in between them. Proverbs 29:1 says this: "A man who hardens his neck after much reproof will suddenly be broken beyond remedy." Isn't he a vivid illustration of that? Someone who God graciously warned and warned. For 40 years, he filled the role of judge, and now his death has created a leadership vacuum that will be filled by Samuel. We've already been introduced to him. He will enter the scene in chapter 7, leading the Israelites to defeat the Philistines, exhibiting that he was the one that they should have perhaps looked to. All these things had to elapse. The end of an era had to be closed out before the new day would dawn with Samuel. But 40 years he served in that role. Verse 19, he continues on. "Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant and about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was taken, and that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she kneeled down and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman who stood by her said to her, 'Do not be afraid, you have given birth to a son.' But she did not answer or pay attention. And she called the boy Ichabod, saying, 'The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken, and because of her father-in-law and her husband.' She said, 'The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken.'" We don't really hear anything about the wives of Hophni and Phinehas prior to this, the wife of Eli, anything like that. Interestingly enough, though, the author, he looks at how she dies and the situation that unfolds there, and most importantly, the name that she grants this child, he sees significance here. He sees this as an appropriate pronouncement on the close of the time of the judges. That's the significance here. He brings this in at last because of the name that she grants this son. We might remember that the book began with a woman who cried out to the Lord and from a bitter heart, right? A situation of bitterness. She cried out to the Lord. She receives a son and she names him Samuel, exclaiming, "Because I have given him to God." Now we see a woman again with great bitterness of soul, but she does not express her faith in God. She does not call upon the Lord. Rather, she is consumed with that bitterness and resigns herself to despair and to die. Ichabod, the glory has departed. Two very different ways that you can respond to bitterness is what we see in these two women. This closing of the chapter, very dark chapter in Israel's history, it would be over a century, it would be over half a century before the events of that day would be reversed. Certainly in a matter of months, the ark came into the possession of Israel again. But note what we read in 1 Chronicles chapter 13. 1 Chronicles chapter 13, beginning in verse 2, it says, "David said to all the assembly of Israel, 'If it seems good to you, and if it is from the Lord our God, let us send everywhere to our kinsmen who remain in all the land of Israel, also to the priests and Levites who are with them in their cities with pasture lands, that they may meet with us. And let us bring back the ark of our God to us, for we did not seek it in the days of Saul.' Then all the assembly said that they would do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people." That's an interesting statement. We did not seek it in the days of Saul. Saul did not bring a new spiritual tone to the nation. We see some very positive things out of Saul, but really, the way that they were treating the ark was really symbolic. It was a reflection, if you will, of their regard concerning God. David was a man after God's own heart, and he is the first one. And now we see the people. And they bobbled it back here. And things had deteriorated in Israel to the point where they were even able to lose the ark to the Philistines. But 50-some years later, they are bringing it back under David, beginning to a spiritual revival in the nation of Israel under his rule, and then under Solomon as they built the temple. As I look at this passage, you immediately say, okay, what is the application to us under the new covenant? What is the application to us in the New Testament? Again, I really don't see Israel as putting the Lord to the test here. I really see this as demonstrating just how bad it had gotten in Israel, just how far from the Lord, how ignorant of the Lord they were, how that they were just as, they did not know the Lord, just like Hophni and Phinehas didn't know the Lord. When people start trusting in the box, when people start trusting in the objects, even as ordained of the Lord as they might be, it is a sign that you do not know the Lord. When people start putting their trust in things like baptism, is baptism ordained of the Lord? That's why we call it an ordinance. What about the Lord's table? We celebrated this morning. When people start to look to these things as what is in fact of spiritual power and spiritual significance, it reveals that they don't know the Lord, that they are ignorant of him, and they have taken his system and things that indeed, you know, the name of the Lord can be on their lips, and they're obviously clinging to things that he has ordained, and yet they're functioning like ignorant pagans. They don't know who he is. They are lost. And it's a frightening thing to think that you can speak of the Lord in one voice, you know, in the same voice that you suddenly speak of the objects that he has ordained as saving you, as being perhaps a means of grace. I don't like those descriptions for the Lord's table, for baptism, a means of grace. What does that mean? Is there something being conveyed through here? That's exactly what the word sacrament would seem to imply. So there is concern in that regard. We see, again, you know, there have been centuries. We talk about Israel. There's been centuries of people who have put their faith and trust in things that God has ordained, but really don't know him. It's a frightening thing that people can just kind of fly on autopilot and have their rational reasons. But, you know, have they consulted the prophet? Have they consulted the confirmed prophet to say, okay, are we really viewing these things? Do we really know this God? To think that these people could be in an earthly physical relationship with God, and even the Philistines know all the great things that God has done for Israel, and yet Israel doesn't know him, and they're functioning like their pagan neighbors. It's a frightful thing. It makes you want to check your heart and make sure that you know the Lord and aren't just have his words on your lips, but your hearts are far from him. Let's close in a word of prayer. We thank you, Father, for the truth of your word.